Maghreb, I agree then, over golden grove and leaving by and by. Leaves like the things of man, you with your fresh.
That is Natalie Merchant. In the 1980s and 90s, Natalie was the lead singer for 10,000 Maniacs, went on to an amazing solo career, settled down for a time to have a baby, and emerged 3 years ago with a new album, Leave Your Sleep, a collection of poems written by others and set to her music. Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Next week, Natalie Merchant travels to Columbus to perform with the Columbus Symphony's Picnic with the Pops. For more information, go to the link at WOSU.org/allsides. Natalie joins us now to talk about the iterations of her career and what she'll bring to Columbus next week. Welcome to the show, Natalie Merchant.
Hello, thank you.
How long have you been performing with symphonies in this way?
I've been doing this program for 5 years now. Four years, actually.
How does the experience compare and contrast to traveling with musicians that you're familiar with?
Well, there are so many differences. And I'd say probably the biggest one is the, I think the emotional range that the orchestra is able to provide and the textures. I'm really attracted to the different textures that the orchestra contains. I love the woodwind section and the winds and the brass and the range of, like I said, the dynamic range, the emotional range is pretty broad.
Is it easy coming into a town? I'm not sure. How do you rehearse? How do you prepare?
That's a little nerve-wracking. We usually send our scores 2 weeks in advance in two large cases, and the orchestra will meet with me the day of the show, and we'll have a two-and-a-half-hour rehearsal, and then we do the show in the evening. And I usually travel with an acoustic guitar player, and a pianist. Sometimes my own conductor, but in this case, we'll be using the conductor from your orchestra.
My guest, Natalie Merchant, the renowned singer-songwriter and former lead singer for the band 10,000 Maniacs. If you have a question or comment for Natalie, you're welcome to give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. What in Leave Your Sleep, the collection of poems I mentioned earlier set to your music, what inspired you in the direction of someone else's words?
Well, the project was inspired by the birth of my daughter, and I was immersing myself in children's literature, and I was really drawn to the poetry of my own childhood and also just exploring new poetry that I'd like to introduce her to. And I wanted to keep writing music, but with a young baby and toddler and then preschooler. This project went on for five to seven years, 5 years of writing, a year of recording, then a year of promoting, and sort of took me through her entire younger half of her childhood. So that was the inspiration. I really didn't have the hours and hours of introspection that I'd had before I had a kid. So I didn't really have time to write lyrics.
The tons of introspection. Well, let's listen to a cut from that album. It's called Coming Out in Spring. I'm sorry, it's called Spring and Fall.
Right.
Okay. Sorry, that's not the cut. That's not the cut, Natalie. Listeners.
I don't really remember that one.
But it is a children's version of a song, by the way.
When I put Take Me Out to the Ball Game.
Yeah, exactly. So it was. And we'll be talking about that later, folks. while we deconstruct what happened there and figure it out, I'll move on. There's a book to go with that album, and I was wondering why that was important.
Well, I did quite a bit of research about the lives of the poets. The project had so many different dimensions. All these poets had really interesting lives. Many of them were British Victorians, like Edward Lear and Christina Rossetti and Robert Louis Stevenson. And I read all their biographies, and then I decided I should write these sort of informational, personal essays about them. And it turned out to be this 80-page book that came along with the CD. And my label is Nonesuch, and they're known for putting out really beautiful packaging. And I had a book designer from London named David Pearson do the design. And we decided that in this era of digital downloading, that if you give people something substantial and worth holding and keeping, and they might actually buy the CD. And we found that people bought it was a double CD with the 80-page book, that people bought that 2-to-1 over the digital download. Gratifying. All that work for something.
Well, it looks beautiful. Did the learning more about the writers, the poets, influence how you interpreted it? Or did you write the music and then learn about the poets?
Usually I investigated their lives after I'd done the work. You know, Spring and Fall, which is the piece that
we will get to
when we first came in, that was a poem written by Jared Manley Hopkins. And he was a Victorian British poet, but he was he had been raised Anglican, but then converted to Catholicism and became a Jesuit priest. And when he took his vows, he burned most of his poetry and then took a sort of vow of silence as far as, speaking to his muse for 7 years. And then began writing poetry again. And when he died, the brothers in his order found his poetry, and there was debate about whether they should destroy the poems or save them. And thank God, a friend of his rescued the poems. So I think it's poems almost mystical discussion of death with a child. I love the last line, Margaret. It's the blight man was born for. It is Margaret that you mourn for. Just telling a child that when you see the death of anything, whether it's a flower or a season or an experience of any sort, that you're feeling your own death, and that's why it touches us so deeply.
Well, let's hopefully hear a cut from Spring and Fall right now.
Okay.
Margaret, are you grieving over golden grove and leaving by and by? Leaves like the things of man you with your fresh thoughts care.
That's Natalie Merchant singing Spring and Fall. Natalie, that's beautiful.
It's so beautiful. The opening line, Margaret, are you grieving over Golden Grove? I'm leaving. And Jared Manley Hopkins was so well known, these kind of invented phrases. And I just love the poem.
It's beautiful. At your concerts, you talk about issues that are important to you, and that's nothing new. And I've heard that at lots of different kinds of concerts. The artist talks about issues they care about. I was reading a post from a longtime fan of yours that said, I can't thank Natalie enough for bringing so many social justice and environmental issues to my consciousness as a young adult in the 1980s and 90s. She continues to do so as a matter of care and conscience. How do you decide that something is worthy of that kind of attention, that you have a captive, in a way, audience, and you're going to talk about something other than music?
Well, lately, this is actually pertinent to your state. Lately, we've been involved pretty deeply in a campaign against hydraulic fracturing. We don't have it in New York yet. We have many counties in central New York that are 50% leased to the gas company. We have an infrastructure pipeline that's been built. And we have a governor who has been upholding a moratorium. We're going on 5 years for the study of the health impacts. You, unfortunately, in Ohio, have quite a bit of fracking. And I actually received a letter from a woman named Jamie Frederick, Frederick, who lives in Coatesville, Ohio, and her water had been contaminated by hydraulic fracturing chemicals, and she was nearly killed. She had to have her gallbladder removed. She had perpetual illness, nausea, and the value of her house plummeted from $125,000 to zero, overnight. And we're seeing that happen in Colorado. We're seeing it happen in Pennsylvania. We're seeing it happen in West Virginia, Texas. They're even fracking in California, where there's such water scarcity, and then on top of fault lines and in heavily populated areas. So I just pinpointed this as a really important issue because it's happening to the entire country, but it's threatening my own backyard.
I've also read sometimes fans don't like it when you do that. And I've heard that about, once again, other artists. Fans complain when they take the stage and talk about an issue that may be controversial, but in any event is important to them. How do you respond to people who are critical of you for doing that?
Well, I've been a musician for 33 years now, and the first benefit, the first gig the 10,000 minutes ever played was a benefit. And there was a plan to locate low-level radioactive waste in our county. And that was one of our first shows. So it's my own. It's part of my history. It's part of my ideology. It's just part of who I am. I do this as a citizen. Now I do this as a mother. And I just happen to be a musician. I don't usually take on a cause that I'm not really in an important and meaningful, serious way attached to.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to educate myself as well as I can, but for the most part, I put the people who represent the nonprofit that I'm benefiting, I put them on stage and have them talk about the issue because it's what they do 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And what I say to people who don't like it is then you probably don't really like me as an artist because it's so intertwined with what I do and who I am.
Last year, you and your band performed Motherland, the cover from your third solo album. It was released in 2001 by Elektra, and the event was an anti-fracking rally in New York. And I thought we could exit on that note after I thank you very much for joining us today. I look forward to the concert next week. And listeners, go to our website to find a link for more information about Natalie Merchant's performance next week in Columbus. And Natalie Merchant, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's Natalie Merchant. Let's listen.
Where in hell can you go? Far from the things that you know. Far from the sprawl of concrete that keeps crawling its way. But a thousand miles.
Support comes from the Jazz Arts Group, taking jazz to a wilder place as the Columbus Jazz Orchestra returns to the stage at the Columbus Zoo and Aquarium for the 8th season of Jazz Zoo. The summer series kicks off July 12th. Tickets, reserve tables, and more details at jazzartsgroup.org.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, renting out your power tools, your car, even rooms in your house, we'll look at the new peer-to-peer sharing economy from Airbnb to Uber. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
This afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News.
The WOSU Member Card Benefit of the Month for July is the Columbus Children's Theater. Enjoy 2-for-1 admission all month long. Visit WOSU.org.
Welcome back to All Sides with Dan Fisher. The baseball season is well underway. Maybe you follow the Indians or the Reds or the Clippers. Or maybe you also come from a place where everybody knows your name, but in the outside world, nobody's heard of your team. Award-winning essayist Lucas Mann spent a year with such a team, a Class A minor league outfit in the Mississippi River town of Clinton, Iowa, chronicling a world inhabited by fiercely loyal fans who want to see their team win, knowing that the players who make that happen probably won't return the next year. Lucas Mann was born in New York City and received his master's in fine arts from the University of Iowa, where he is currently the provost's visiting writer in nonfiction. His essays and stories have appeared in or are forthcoming from Wigleaf, Barrel House, New South, Columbia, a journal of literature and art, and the Kenyon Review. He lives in Iowa City. The name of his new book is Class A Baseball in the Middle of Everywhere. And he joins us now by telephone from Iowa. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for having me.
I have a question for our listeners before we get started. Are you from a town with a Class A baseball team? Give us a call and a shout out to your hometown and your team. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also do that on Facebook as well. Lucas Mann, you're the provost, visiting writer in nonfiction at the University of Iowa, but baseball has been a part of your life for a long, long time. So it was natural, I suppose, that you make it part of this your first book. But how did you pick the Clinton Lumber Kings?
I think it was just sort of a series of really good fortune. I was out in Iowa doing my MFA, and you need to write a thesis to do that. And one of the nice things about it is that it forces you to write and to find something to write about. And I'm not a sports writer by any stretch, but I was sort of stuck, and I wanted to find a topic or a place that might sort of jar something within me and be emotionally resonant and that I could really get into. And I knew that there was low-level minor league around me. And Clinton, just in doing a little sort of cursory research, jumped out as one of the smallest population-wise towns in the country to still have a minor league baseball team. They play in this sort of amazing field that hasn't really been changed much since 1937 when it was built. And I drove in to meet some of the people who ran the team, and just the look of the stadium right on the banks of the Mississippi, I was just like, oh my God, I need to come back here over and over again.
The town is very multi-layered. I was interested in how you started the book, describing in some detail its history as a place for firebugs. I mean, people start fires there, or things start on fire there. And then there's one reference later on in the book where you're saying you were talking with someone, and as we stared off into the distance, where a plume of smoke was tell me about what you learned about Clinton that made it into the book, and why the story is as much about that as the team almost.
Sure. Yeah. One of my goals was to sort of let the book and the story develop organically and naturally, and sort of respond to the things that people were telling me and the things that I got to know. And I got to know a lot of the fans really well, and they sort of forced their way into the narrative because they were so present. And Clinton seems like the kind of place where the history is present. It's discussed constantly. Even the name of the team, the Lumber Kings, is a very overt reference to a little over a century ago when Clinton was a lumber processing empire, and there were more millionaires per capita in Clinton than anywhere else in the country for a brief moment. And that history is sort of constantly referenced. And then, you know, we'd be talking and people would be talking about a house near them burning down or various fires that had been set to their high school in the past. And it just sort of seemed to be this sort of really stark juxtaposition of this infrastructure that was built for a town like Clinton when it was booming. And then all of these buildings gone old, and in some cases gone on empty and sort of ripe for catching fire. And that was sort of a really vivid juxtaposition to think about when I was writing.
You know, you follow the Yankees, right? You're from New York City.
Yes.
I'm wondering about what it's like then. And I know you're not a sports writer, but you played baseball all the way through, and you actually played for Vassar College.
I did the powerhouse. Yeah.
2 years. Hey, you know what? There's a lot of people out there that would love to play any college baseball, and you know that very well. But how did you? Were you surprised by anything about this lowest rung of full season professional baseball?
I think one thing that was really nice is sort of not coming from a background of ever really having tried to write about sports, and not being from here, very much being an outsider to this place, which is something that I hope is sort of dealt with frankly in the book. Mm-hmm. I didn't really have any expectations beyond sort of seeing the stadium in the wintertime for the first time when there was still snow on it, and sort of thinking these overblown thoughts about, you know, how beautiful and pure that is. but beyond that, I didn't really know anything. So it was just constantly, everything was a surprise from the beginning. I guess one thing that stuck out was how good the players were, and then also how bad they could look in sort of an instant because they were young, but mostly just how overwhelming it was to be that close to people that are that talented, and 99% of them will never make it to a place where a lot of people see them.
Yeah, I think the only guy I knew personally who made it to the minors played for the Burlington Bees. I think back in the 70s, he was hit in the head during a game and concussed, and then eventually left. And that happens. He had lost his college scholarship. He gave up his college scholarship to make a go of it. And for some, you know, it's a huge risk. And you write about that. Some of them, they're throwing it all into this Class A minor league team.
Yeah, it's really remarkable. And those stakes, I guess it was a different experience in the stands than I'd ever felt, because the stakes are so tremendous while they're simultaneously not at all. Like in terms of the team winning really meaning anything to the large scale, in terms of there being sort of a championship that mattered beyond the town. There weren't those stakes, but you could really palpably feel that if you were watching a 19-year-old kid who had a lot invested and whose family had a lot invested in this, if you watched him enough games in a row strike out poorly, those stakes were there, and you would be sort of whispering to the people next to you, I don't know how much longer he has in this. And that makes it riveting in a sad way, but you're watching something that really means a lot to the people, because it's survival and it's sort of staying involved in the only thing that they've ever done seriously.
And then when they're injured or possibly injured, I think in the early in the book, there's some guy, his hand gets hit by the ball or something. And everyone's like,
And any little thing, the fragility of it is remarkable. Any sort of tweaked muscle, or, you know, anything worse, a little thing happens and you find out that a guy needs surgery and his whole life changes.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and I'm talking with Lucas Mann. He has written a new book. It's called Class A, Baseball in the Middle of Everywhere. If you have a question or comment for Lucas about Class A baseball, you want to tell us about your Class A baseball team and from your town, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. I don't know when I'm going to talk about this again, so this is the chance you've been waiting for. The town is dominated by a very big factory, and they're lucky to have it. It's what? How many? It's a mile long?
It's just about a mile long.
What does the physical presence of the factory, or how does it play a role in your story?
That's another example of something that just sort of forced its way into the story with me sort of being there and sort of constantly trying to figure out what was going on and what I wanted to write about. It was unignorable. And especially the only real way to drive into town, because it's at the easternmost part of Iowa, so the only way to drive in from Iowa is along Highway 30, and you come into the town along Highway 30, and the first thing that you see is the factory, and it just keeps going and going and going. And depending on what kind of production day it is, the smoke is so thick and carries a real sort of stench some days, that it feels like it literally dominates the town. it feels like the gatekeeper as you drive in. It feels like it looms over everything else because it's certainly longer and it's also taller than most every other building. So it really physically is a metaphor for itself and just how important it is to the town as the employer.
Yeah, there's just 2,400 people in the town?
That's 26,000, roughly.
I'm sorry.
All right.
A hyperbole in the opposite direction. The story... Well, we got a call from Bill in Westerville. He has a story about the Clinton Ballpark. Let's hear from him right now. Hi, Bill in Westerville. You're on the air with Lucas Mann.
Yeah, first-time caller. Listen to you a lot and enjoy the show.
Thank you.
My wife is from Clinton, and I'm from not very far from there, and we've been to that ballpark several times. And several years ago, I was reading Reader's Digest, and they had a story about three boys who came up with a scheme. The ballpark has a fence around it, and there's when you go into the ballpark, you can just go through a gate, and they have people from the club, I guess, who, if a foul ball comes up out of the stadium, it will land inside that fence, and they get the ball. They don't let the kids keep it. So these three boys came up with a plan. And what they did was, when a ball came over, one of them grabbed it. He was inside the fence, and he threw it over the fence to a boy who was on the outside, who threw it to a boy that was up by the railroad tracks on a bicycle. And he fired it up there, and the kid took off with a bike, and they had their ball. But it's a beautiful little park, and we've enjoyed many, many times there. Did see Goose Gossage pitch there one time when he was with Appleton.
Would that be Appleton, Wisconsin?
Yes.
I lived there for a few years when I was a kid.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, it's a small world, small country.
Yes, it is.
Well, Bill, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thanks, Bill.
Mm-hmm.
Are there like a million stories like that, Lucas?
I think so. I think a lot of my role and one of the things that was so fun in the research process is I got to know people in Clinton and sort of sit with the same people in the stands every day is that I sort of became a story repository, kind of, and sort of every bit of personal lore and town lore that had been stored up and only shared sort of among the people who also experienced it, I was sort of there and willing and excited to hear it. So it sort of felt like while I was watching the action, I was getting these sort of personal histories narrated over it, you know, little anecdotes like that one or just sort of larger things about, you know, what the town was like 20 years ago. And so it felt like I couldn't be in the town without hearing these sort of these references to little moments in people's lives. And that was a real pleasure.
How well did people accept you, especially the team, in the long run? You know, a lot of these guys are from other countries. How did they take to you?
I think it was a mix. And again, the book is really, you know, it's not objectively reported.
No.
And sort of I myself am in there a lot in my feelings. So that's something that's discussed, is sort of this tension between feeling like I get to be in the clubhouse, feeling like, you know, I'm trying to be a reporter, but I also am just sort of in awe of these guys, which I think probably came across very much to them. And then also I was intruding on their place of business and their lives. And so it was sort of a constant back and forth. And I think I got really close with some players, was sort of ignored by some players. And then in a lot of ways was just sort of this fixture sitting there playing cards with guys or staring at them too long. I was there all season. And it just sort of, I think that something that seems to happen for baseball players when they're itinerant like that in the minor leagues is that I just become one of those fixtures, like the people that you see in the stands, like the person that might put you up, like the person that you get coffee from every day, that is sort of this constant in their lives and is part of what makes their experience what it is for 6 months. And then they're gone and they won't see me again. So I think in a lot of ways I fell into that role. And then on the fan side, I just clicked with this one group of season ticket holders, and they were just remarkably welcoming. So I would sort of spend my afternoons and mornings in the clubhouse with the team before games, sort of working out whether I deserve to be there and sort of the tension and what they thought of me and what they thought of them. And then they'd go play and I'd go sit next to these same fans and feel like I was a part of this family. So there was that back and forth tension all the time.
You were also Louis the Lumber King.
Yeah.
Now, were you that for the whole season or?
I wasn't. No, I was just that for an evening. Thank God.
That's what starts the book. The story off is you're preparing to become Louis the Lumber King, which is the mascot.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of caught my eye when you made the reference to how much you enjoyed actually having the people stare at you. And that was something that I'm trying to think of which player, maybe it's the player from Nicaragua who said that's what he liked. He was a pitcher, right?
Yeah.
Interesting parallel.
You know, the mascot experience was, I mean, you know, I say that I'm happy that I only did it once because it's really smelly in there. but it did sort of present this moment where for the one time in the season, I was an actor in the drama that was happening. I was out on the field and wasn't a spectator, but was being looked at. And it was sort of amazing to think about and write about how instant a rush that was. And it sort of seems like in sports, in sort of the ecosystem of sports teams, and that's sort of the balance that's always happening is who gets to be a real part of it and who's just appreciating it. And then different people who sort of appreciate the game wanting to feel like they're more a part of it, wanting to feel like they're part of the action. And I was certainly feeling that all season. And I just thought it was very funny how the moment I put on this mascot's outfit and grabbed a flag and ran onto the field, I felt different. I felt validated. And it really sort of was a reminder of this very primal thing that playing sports keys into, I think, for anybody.
When that game that you played, the mascot, was mm-hmm. that one of the, did you know the fans by then? But they didn't know
I
it
did,
was
yeah.
you. But they didn't know it was you then, right?
I think some of them did.
Okay.
I say in the book, I had this whole elaborate plan of doing a reveal. And then I think I got excited and told a few of them. So it was a mix.
Well, it's a pretty funny way. It was really enjoyable reading that and starting with that story. My guest is Lucas Mann. He's the author of a new book. It's nonfiction. It's called Class A, Baseball in the Middle of Everywhere. And he's also a provost visiting writer in nonfiction at the University of Iowa. If you want to talk about Class A baseball today, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And just to be sure, Lucas, in the title of the book, is it Class A baseball, colon, in the middle of everywhere? I mean, or is it Class A baseball in the middle of everywhere? How does that work?
Class A, so Class A is the title.
Okay.
And then the subtitle is Baseball in the Middle of Everywhere.
All right. Then I got it right the first time. That's Lucas Mann. We'll be continuing our conversation with him after this. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Robin Young. Coming up on Here and Now, musician Peter Gabriel describes his piano duet with a primate who learned how to use a computerized keyboard.
So he comes in never having sat at this keyboard before and then does this fantastic sort of triplet improvisation.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon from 2 till 4 on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from the Council for Older Adults of Delaware County, helping to provide compassionate in-home care for older loved ones. Its mission is to help older people live safely at home and avoid unnecessary institutional care. More at growingolder.org.
Join WOSU TV for America's favorite Independence Day celebration this Thursday night with a Capitol Fourth. From Washington, D.C., enjoy performances from some of the country's best-known musicians, as well as one of the greatest displays of fireworks in the nation, including the favorite tradition, Tchaikovsky's 1812 Overture, complete with live cannon fire. Celebrate with a Capitol Fourth Thursday night at 8 on WOSU TV.
Support 89.7 NPR News at $85 and receive the WOSU member card. Good for discounts at more than 200 partners. Visit wosu.org/membercard.
Take me out to the ball game. Take me out to the crowd. Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jacks. I don't care if I ever get back.
All righty. This is Lucas Mann is with us. He's the author of Class A, Baseball in the Middle of Everywhere. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513. His story is about the Lumber Kings of Clinton, Iowa. It's a Mississippi River town. And his experience during their 2010 season. 614-292-8513 is the number to call if you want to tell us about your favorite Class A team out there or have a question for Lucas Mann. Lucas, you're going to read an excerpt from your book now. Is it about that player from Nicaragua that we talked about earlier?
Yeah, it's sort of looking at the stands from his point of view.
Okay.
His name is Erasmo Ramirez, and he's a pitcher. And I guess I'll just start. Erasmo glances up to the stands. Worn white faces look back at him. When he got called to Class A ball in a place he'd never heard of, Erasmo didn't realize that it would be the same people here each night in this small stadium, that it would be so easy to pick out individuals as they call his name. Sometimes his BlackBerry rings, and it's reporters from the biggest newspapers in Nicaragua. They want to know everything because he's important now. On his laptop screen is an article from just a week ago telling the nation that Erasmo Ramirez is the best pitcher in a place called Clinton, Iowa. When the readers in his home city of Rivas imagine him thousands of miles away, asking and all of his accolades and wishes fulfilled, they don't think of this. Semicircular bleachers with a few rows of dark seats, above which it's just metal benches, long and low, with the usual bodies dotted along them at various points like a bored student's pencil marks on a clean page. Green poles rise up between the sands and hold a tin roof that hums when the wind blows hard off the river. If you took a picture of this scene, tinted it sepia and burned the edges, it would be believable as something pulled from a time capsule of the game, from rubble, from ash. This is a Depression-era building, a WPA initiative, one of 3,300 stadiums built in a two-year sprint, all virtually identical, now mostly gone. The crown jewel of the project, Tiger Stadium in Detroit, was bulldozed into a parking lot 2 years ago.
I was going to ask you about that segment because Erasmus is idolized in Nicaragua mm-hmm. because he's playing in the United States. But later on, you know, you make it a distinction between the impact of the fans and the majors and the impact in a Class A team like the Lumber Kings. He can hear them when he's playing for the Lumber Kings, and it's different.
Yeah, it's sort of a totally different kind of fandom, right? Because, you know, with these players, what they're sort of hoping for, their ultimate aspiration is to be performing in front of this giant monolith of 50,000 people who are all screaming for them in this big wall. That's sort of the ultimate dream that little kids have. And instead, in single A, you don't get that enormous scope that makes you feel like a globally important person, but instead you get people who see you every day and are so close to you that when you walk into the dugout, they can look at you in the eyes and have a conversation and give you a piece of candy. So it's this really small, intimate experience that's, I think, wonderful for the fans, but in a lot of times, I think, can make the players feel small.
And by the way, there is a woman who does give the players a piece of candy.
Yes, yeah, she does that every game.
The way you described her setting up her candy on the ledge, it sounded like how some people set up their their Lucky Charms and that kind of thing in a what am I trying to say, a bingo game.
Right, yeah, that's very, very meticulous order to it.
Yeah, the other talismans and so forth. Paul in Worthington, you're on the air with Lucas Mann. Welcome, Paul.
Hello. Hey, Lucas, I was just wondering that now that there seems to be so much money kind of pouring into these minor league baseball teams, they're almost used as an economic development, especially things like the Dayton Dragons.
Yeah. We can barely hear you, I'm sorry to say. We're going to have to, I don't know where the it's coming from, but I'm sorry to say we can't.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Okay. Yep.
Well.
Can I respond to a little bit of what I heard?
Yeah, he was going to ask about how big a deal money is in that at that level.
Yeah, I mean, from the team context, you know, I heard him say the Dayton Dragons, and they're a single-A team that's in Dayton, obviously, which is a much bigger city, and they can sort of sell out, I think, basically every game, 8,000 people. And more, even in the low levels of the minors, teams are sort of gravitating towards that money. And that's one of the things that makes Clinton so unique. It's actually locally owned. And it's community owned by stockholders who are almost all in the community, and the shares are passed down from generation to generation. So while a vast majority of teams that had long histories in towns like Clinton are gone and have moved to bigger cities like Dayton, Clinton has this ability to sort of cling to its team, and really has. So just their existence is sort of this very stubborn flying in the face of the economics of how minor league baseball is going, which is something that I just thought was really great to be a part of. When people say it's our team, in a lot of cases they really mean that they own a part of it.
It is a minor for the Seattle Mariners. Do they have lots of teams like the Lumber Kings?
Every major league team has their sort of their place in every rung. So they'll have one or two teams in rookie ball, the first place where they send people, which isn't a full season. And then Clinton is low A. And so a lot of teams, every team has a low A team somewhere. Then there's high A, then there's double A, and then there's triple A. So Clinton is just sort of a stop on this path that they have mapped out for their players.
Does everybody take these kinds of paths? And is it incremental for everyone?
I think it depends. That's sort of one of the things that makes it so charged about watching a Class A team. If you get to see a really exciting prospect, you know that he's an exciting prospect, and then you also know that there's a really good chance that you only see him for like a month. So you're sort of in this weird combination of rooting for his success because you got to see him before he became big, but also maybe hoping that he's not so successful that he leaves soon. There's that balance. And then there's some, you know, real, real superstars probably won't come through a place like Clinton. If they're that good, they might skip and go to double A. But by and large, you see guys who in some cases were first or second round draft picks who got signing bonuses of over $1 million. And then the first thing that they do is go to a place like Clinton, Iowa.
I was going to bring that up too. Some of the players already are millionaires with their signing bonuses. Others are not eligible for the draft at all. They're free agents, sleeping four or five together on the floor of an efficiency unit or more. Do those differences splinter the team at all? How does this in and out, sort of this revolving door, how does that pull a team together or pull it apart?
It's really remarkable the way that that balance is sort of upheld. I think one of the things about sports is that it's sort of amazing how you can get people who are into sports, either playing it or watching it, to sort of buy into something like this idea of, you know, what being a good teammate is. So I think that sort of tradition is always hanging over everything. So in the clubhouse, there's still this general idea of, we're going to win it together, boys. You know, this is my teammate. This is my brother. I root for him. That is said, I think, sometimes in earnest and sometimes in lip service. And then that's balanced with the reality of, if you're a shortstop or a middle infielder in general who's sort of overachieved his whole life and maybe only got $2,000 as a signing bonus, and there's a shortstop on the team who made $1 million as a signing bonus, and the team has a lot invested in his success,
mm-hmm.
you have to watch him play every day and sort of know that he will be given every chance to succeed, and that in a lot of ways you are sort of an expendable roster filler that allows people like him to succeed. So I was sort of amazed by the grace and maturity with which that dynamic was handled by a lot of young guys. But it's definitely there. The clubhouse is sort of defined by inequality in a lot of ways.
And some of how the way you described how some of them have to live mm-hmm. practically on top of each other, not eating necessarily very well.
No.
Not living very healthy lives because they're just kids, a lot of them, living on their own for the first time.
Yeah, it's an amazingly grueling thing to think about, especially if you're coming right out of high school or if you're a kid coming from Latin America and sometimes you're 18, 19, 20 years old, and you're out on your own, in some cases, for the first time. It's an 140-game season with maybe 5 or 6 days off sprinkled in between. And then after each game ends at 11 or sometimes at midnight, you have to figure out dinner for yourself, which is usually whatever's open, which is usually McDonald's. And then you go fall asleep in a cramped apartment, and you're trying to budget for yourself. And some guys are trying to budget within their meager pay to send money back home. So it is an incredibly grueling experience for these guys.
The story is about you. You've mentioned that as earlier as well as your relationship with baseball, with your father, with your late brother.
Mm-hmm.
How did it work in your mind to when and how to write yourself into this chronicle of another place so far from your hometown of New York City and the Yankees and the death of your brother as well?
Yeah, I wanted the book to be multifaceted where it felt like it was pushing me in that direction. And I don't know how much sense that makes. But, you know, I like, as somebody who writes essays and writes literary nonfiction, I really gravitate towards nonfiction that surprises you and does things that maybe you wouldn't necessarily think just from a blurb or a subtitle. And so I realized when I was sitting watching that so much of the story for me was about how baseball gives you all of this time for thought and reflection. And that's sort of what makes it unique. You watch a baseball game, and there's so much dead air. It's people telling stories, it's people remembering things, it's people thinking about things. And so I realized that instead of trying to shy away from that and just sort of force it into a more journalistic chronicle, I thought it would be interesting to try and in some ways sort of replicate that sort of long, mind-wandering malaise of when you sit and watch baseball on a hot summer day and you remember things from your own life and you miss people and you regret things, and all of that sort of mixes in with the action. I wanted to try to do justice to that feeling.
Did you walk around with a notepad?
I did, yes.
And were people... Did you ever think people were talking to? Well, I'm sure some people were talking to you just because of who you are and what you were trying to do. Do you think that you achieved enough of a fly on a wall? Were you there with them so long through the whole season that you achieved some kind of fly on the wall experience?
I think it was a balance, and I sort of tried to you know, I'm sort of the school of thought that the idea of a person being a fly on a wall is a bit crazy because we're not flies.
I agree.
yes. And so as opposed to sort of trying to force myself, both while I was doing the research and in the writing process, as though I was just sort of a pair of eyes blinking out from a locker observing things, I was there, and you know, guys would sort of look at me warily sometimes, and I would recognize that, or we'd all go out and get drunk together and people's guards would be down and I would recognize that too. So I think it was this balance, and it's sort of remarkable. I'd never done a long narrative research project like this before. So one of the things that was constantly interesting to me was this balance between people knowing what you were doing there, but then also you just becoming a fixture and becoming a presence. And sort of you being there with your notebook just seeps into part of what their experience is. So that I wanted to sort of write into that tension, and I was really curious to see how it played out. And I think it ended up being a mixture of the two. I think that I got really close with some people, and I think that there was always that reserve there as well.
When you referred to Thirsty Thursday, it cracked me up. I assume a day. I cannot remember the full quote, but I assume that's a day in which there's a deal on drafts or something.
Yes.
It reminded me of Dime Dog Night at a Clippers game. And
you, yeah.
And you said that the house is always decently packed on days when alliteration can be made to signify fun.
Yeah, I think that's universally true.
There was a paragraph in the first chapter, I think, about how everybody knew where everybody was ranked when they came in. Mm-hmm. They're all in the same room, but wildly different circumstances. And you've talked about that a little bit. And the way you describe how they size each other up and stuff, I have to tell you, we just have about a minute left, but it evoked some sort of Shawshank Redemption prison scene for me. Where they're all kind of, you know, they all know each other's story and, you know, how are they going to play it? You know, it was.
And I mean, a similar thing, too, in that comparison is that it's this weird balance between sizing each other up and knowing that they are the people standing in each other's way from their ultimate goals. Also, they're the only people that are their friends in the moment,
right.
And who understand their experience. So it's these two polar opposite feelings of anger, jealousy, and then like love and camaraderie that have to coexist.
Yeah, must have been a fascinating experience to spend a year, or not a year, but a season with a team at that level. And thank you so much for sharing your stories with us today.
Thank you, Ann.
The name of his book, it's called Class A, Baseball in the Middle of Everywhere. The author is Lucas Mann. The story's about his experience covering the 2010 season with the Clinton Lumber Kings. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.